latest spy scandal between Moscow and Washington, 11 alleged Russian agents were indicted this week in the United States on charges of illegally exporting sensitive microelectronics through a Texas-based company. The Kremlin, of course, denies the allegations. The latest spy case comes in the heels of the indictment in Germany of two alleged Russian agents that Berlin accuses of trying to procure official and secret EU and NATO documents. Moreover, the EU's intelligence chief recently noted that Russian intelligence is increasingly active in Brussels, which has recently seen espionage activity rise to Cold War levels. But this isn't your father's looking glass war. In the age of the internet and social media, international espionage has entered a whole new dimension. Last month, for example, Russian media reported that the SVR, Moscow's Foreign Intelligence Service, has ordered programs worth an estimated $1 million to monitor the internet and blogosphere and to spread information and disinformation via social media networks that advances the Kremlin's intelligence agenda. Russia's new spy games. What are Moscow's capabilities and what are the goals? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And joining us on the phone from New York City is someone who knows a thing or two about this espionage game. Mark Galliotti, as our listeners should know by now, is a professor at New York University and the author of numerous books on Russia's intelligence services and the author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Always good to be talking.
Always good to be talking to you. Mark, I'll start with you since you had a pretty insightful post on your blog this week on this spy scandal. In fact, it was that post that inspired this podcast. You made a couple of points that really jumped out at me. One is that Russia has raised its intelligence activities all the way to Cold War levels. This after the intelligence services were decimated after the decline of the Soviet Union. This is a point Edward Lucas also makes in his latest book, Deception. Second, you say that Moscow is shifting its focus to economic and technological espionage, which makes sense in this day and age. And finally, that in the U.S. at least, Russia is relying on Russian-born naturalized American citizens to a degree in its espionage activity. Let's get the ball rolling with you explicating on those things.
Well, on one level, the fact that the Russian spy is no big deal. Everybody spies on everyone else. That's just part of the sort of the modern games of tradecraft. And the fact that Russian intelligence services will try and recruit ethnic Russians. Again, one could say, well, that's no big deal. But I think what really comes out from all these points that's most important is first of all, the extent to which the Russians are throwing resources, both material and also political, into espionage. I mean, let's face it, when these networks get blown, and they do, it has considerable international cost to the Russian authorities. But secondly, what it is they're after, because yes, it's technical, it's economic intelligence, everything that'll help sort of try and rebuild Russia, help it catch up. But also there's a subtext, I think, which is that the Russians still see the world as an essentially hostile place. They see that it's a zero-sum game in which Russia essentially has to prosper at the expense of others. It has to find out what's really going on. I think it does speak to a fairly paranoid but also fairly confrontational view of the world.
When you mentioned that they've been getting caught much more often, and this has repercussions. Why do you think they're getting caught more often? Is it that the Western intelligence services are getting better at detecting them, or is it just because of the sheer volume of Russian espionage activity?
I'll give the classic answer, which is a little bit of all of them, quite frankly. In part, yes, the Western intelligence services are getting better. I think particularly because, the extent to which technological means are so central nowadays to modern espionage, whether it's gathering information, transmitting it or whatever, and there clearly the West has the edge. Secondly, yes, there's a lot more of it going on. Therefore, just the law of averages would suggest that more will get caught. But I think there is a third point, and that is that it's hard to detect much of an ideological edge to Russian intelligence operations. The days when people might spy for Moscow out of some sense of real conviction, you know, beyond general patriotism, are gone. Particularly when we're talking about Russians who are not Russian citizens, it tends to be that they're motivated by money. And money can buy you great spies, but the point is, money doesn't necessarily buy you loyalty, money doesn't buy you commitment. You know, again, it's never been proved, but Victor Boot, the arms dealer, who's currently in an American prison, is generally regarded as likely to be a Russian intelligence agent. He's old school. He's unlikely to be talking just because they offer him a deal. Most of the people who are nowadays involved in intelligence activity, particularly if they're not career SVR or GRU military intelligence agents, they're basically doing it for the money. And people you can buy can be bought by someone else as well. So I think there's a lack of loyalties within the service too.
And to what ends is all this? I mean, what is the goal here? Now, I was struck by this this report about the SVR buying these programs to spread information and disinformation over social media and so on. And of course, this makes sense in this day and age, right? But I had to ask the question: what's the goal of that? What are they hoping to accomplish with that?
Well, I mean, generally, all these activities I say have a domestic significance. And that's first and foremost. It's not as though Russia regards itself under any kind of existential threat that tomorrow NATO or China or Georgia will invade it. So, you know, it's all about what happened, how it plays within Russia. And to that extent, I think it's threefold. One is they are very aggressively trying to target people abroad whom they feel support anti-Kremlin elements within Russia. Now, that can be anything from people fundraising for North Caucasus terrorists, and it has to be said there's been a spate of mysterious assassinations, you know, across Europe and beyond of these people. Secondly, I mean, you know, and beyond that,
or
but
not
it's
so
also
mysterious.
Well, unproven in most cases, let's put it that way. You know, as well as people supportive of the opposition. So there's targeting people who could be opposition in any sense of the word. Secondly, the economic dimension. This sense of, you know we need to build up our economic capacities, we know we need to close the technology gap, so let's see how we can steal the technology to try and do that. But the third element, and I think it's the most sort of important but also the most opaque, is what it says, I think, about the mindset of Putin and those around him. I mean, it's very, very hard to talk to people who actually brief Putin. They're not, on the whole, people who are willing to just chat to foreigners. But the very few sort of snippets I've got, either from these people or secondhand, suggests that Putin does have the kind of perspective on the world, and particularly on the West, that's always asking, yeah, but what's really going on? That sense that there always is going to be subplots and conspiratorial dimensions and so forth. I mean, even if we look at the previous ring of spies who were caught in the United States, who were meant to be doing things like penetrating think tanks and finding out what they really think, that there is no such thing as a shy think tank. You know what think tanks say, right? Because 24/7 they're telling everyone on the internet, in their reports, in their lobbying or whatever. But again, from Putin's point of view, that wasn't enough. There has to be something that goes beyond and behind that. So I think, again, it's that sense of, it speaks to a mindset in the Kremlin that says there is always going to be another layer of meaning, another layer of plotting, and we need to know what it is.
So in one level, they're chasing a rabbit here. I mean, what I see here is a lot of projection. I mean, Putin seems to be projecting his own worldview onto others. I know Kirill wants to jump in here. So,
First of all, I'd like to continue several Mark's points. First of all, of course, it's for me, I'm not a specialist in the secret services and so on, but for me...
But I'm sure they have a file on you.
Absolutely. From the beginning of 1980s. By the way, I had been interrogating by KGB officer in the middle of 1980s, so it's okay with this. So, first of all, for me, it's a pure play of paranoia. All this activity of Russian spies in the West, in the United States, and so on. I can explain my point of view. First of all, in modern Russian scientific, technological, political, social context, educational context, all this espionage is absolutely pointless, especially industrial espionage, technological espionage, because for the country itself, for Russian economy, for Russian society, is much, you know, much more convenient and useful to invest into the universities, into the industry, into the, you know, all this infrastructure of economy and the society, but not to invest into, you know, the failed spies.
Right. You're saying all the resources they're putting into espionage, if they would just put this into education, then they wouldn't need the espionage. Because
yes.
Okay.
They can steal, you know, some secrets. Okay, I can believe in this. I just can believe in this. But okay, I imagine they bring that you know, secret to some very important, you know, bureaucrat in Russian government. What else?
Well, this is one of the things I'm trying to get at. What are they? Really
how can they use all these things? Because they're trying all the time from one year to another year, to use some, you know, modern Western technologies and so on, and they failed all that time. They cannot use all these secrets. It's not Soviet times when the infrastructure of scientific researches and technological, you know, technological network of doing some, you know, special weapons and so on existed. Now it's absolutely, you know, just disappeared. And that is, for me, that is a pure paranoid game of some, you know, some people around Putin and Putin himself. That is my first point. Second point is that I'd like to continue this Marx idea about the reasons and the lack of reasons for to become a spy and to spy for modern Russia. In previous times, during Cold War, especially in 1930s and 40s, that was mainly an ideological reasons. Remember all these guys from Cambridge and
yeah.
So on. Now they want money. And it's very interesting that all these reasons are very capitalistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bourgeois idea that you can be a spy because of money, not because of some ideas or some political reasons and so on. Just for money, this is very successful, but to some extent, and. I am absolutely sure, again, I am not a specialist in, Secret Service and so on, but I am absolutely sure that the quality of so-called modern Russian spies are so low because of this.
As Mark pointed out. Yeah.
Yeah. And the third point is that impact of which such stories about Russian spies in the United States and wherever influence modern Russian society. For me, it's more interesting, all this modern Russian obsession with the secret services, with spies and so on. And I'd like to, to discuss this. It's interesting.
Well, I want to get Mark to jump in here, specifically on your first point, that all this espionage is pretty useless because there isn't the educational substructure, if you will,
technological to
use it. What do you think of that, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, in part it reflects the wider problem, I think, with espionage these days. I mean, the question has to be asked, in the days of Google and Google Earth and everything else, quite what value do spies have? I mean, in my time, back when I was at the British Foreign Office, I was a consumer of intelligence materials. And I've got to be honest, and it's no reflection of the spies themselves. I think Britain has one of the most effective intelligence apparatuses in the world. But nonetheless, it was very, very rare that I would see something that came in blazon, top secret, code word X and so forth, that really changed my perspective. Now, in part, that's because I'm an arrogant creature, and therefore I always think I'm right. But it is also that, in fact, nowadays, it's very hard to get intelligence, except on very, very narrow technical military issues, which is likely to take you much further than if you read the newspapers and the smarter news magazines and just generally talk to people you'll know anyway. put that into the technical context, exactly, once again, this is a point of just because you have some chip, the time it would take you to reverse engineer it and put it into work would mean that maybe sort of you could leap straight forward into the previous decade. It doesn't actually take you further. You don't get to leapfrog anyone. So, yeah, I mean, what is most of this for? Most of this is for metrics. Most of this is for agencies that already exist to prove why they deserve their budgets, to prove that they still have some kind of relevance, and to continue their own existence. So you have espionage for the sake of espionage in most cases. Certainly when it comes to economics, it's absolutely right. Frankly, if you've got $1 million to spend, odds are it'd be much better spent on research grants for bright young PhDs in engineering rather than buying some spies and hoping that they're going to come up with some secret widget that the Americans or the Japanese or whoever, no, nowadays even the Chinese, are working on.
Well, if that super secret software that the Foreign Intelligence Service has procured is listening to our podcast right now, maybe they will take your advice and we'll see some grants for Russian universities to educate some
a very positive impact. Yeah, you know, every journalist is speaking about the impact on the society. Yeah, So that is a clear example of this.
Listening? In all seriousness, Mark, this brings us back to another point that I wanted to discuss, is espionage for espionage's sake and matrices and things like that. You wrote on your blog post this week also that this could reverberate, this latest scandal in which apparently Russian agents got caught again. This comes on the heels of agents getting caught in Germany, and it comes a couple of years after the famous Anna Chapman case. Will this reverberate and create a shakeup in the security services? After the Anna Chapman case, there was a lot of speculation that the SVR would get swallowed up by the FSB, the FSB's longstanding desire to recreate the KGB there. Do you see any similar kind of repercussions this time back in Moscow, or other kinds of repercussions back in Moscow?
Yeah, I mean, there will be some repercussions. The question is, as it were, how significant the shockwaves are. Unless this metastasizes into something much, much more embarrassing and much, much more public. I mean, let's be honest. In some ways, it's interesting that you called it the Anna Chapman case, in that, you know, she was one of the least significant of the agents there, but nonetheless, because she had the highest profile. Exactly. I almost feel sorry for the rest. They've now become relegated to being the extras in her movie, as it were. But that, as it were, gave the news media and so forth a nice handle. There's nothing especially sexy about microelectronics being shipped out of Texas through JFK.
Who knows? it's up to point of view. Yeah.
But so, I mean, unless there's some new dimension, this is unlikely to be a sort of at the same scale. Though, of course, the unknown factor is that unless it becomes part of the grist of the US presidential campaign. But there will be repercussions, at least at the sort of the tactical level. I'm sure there's going to be people, whether it's within the SVR or the GRU, that was kind of primarily responsible for this. You know,
Has it been established that the GRU was responsible for this, or is it?
No, it hasn't. I mean, it's just, I mean, most intelligence activity by the Russians is carried out by the SVR. This, though, it had a particular military technical dimension, which doesn't preclude it from being SVR, but, you know, makes it perhaps a bit more likely that it's GRU. We'll find out in due course. But, I mean, Either way, it is clear that the foreign intelligence services are in trouble. I mean, both the SVR and the GRU are in trouble. I mean, the GRU, which is technically the main intelligence directorate of the General Staff, is in many ways fighting for its political autonomy. There's talk of it being relegated to being just an ordinary directorate of the General Staff. That sounds, you know, purely cosmetic, but in fact has a significant impact on how
it's who it reports to.
Exactly, who it reports to, but also its budgetary control and those kind of things which make bureaucrats, even bureaucrats in uniform, very, very excited. And as for the SVR, it's been fighting off attempts by the Internal Security Service, the FSB, to take it over for a long time. And it's not really at the moment sort of covering itself with glory. Mikhail Fradkov, its director, again, hasn't really sort of demonstrated the capacities that are expected of him. But that said, I think at the moment the chances of the FSB getting an expansion of its power are relatively limited, because in some ways this is very much a sideshow at the moment. The big story, and I know it's something you wanted to sort of touch on later, is the whole business of the investigative committee, which is a sort of, as it were, the FSB rival inside Russia rather than outside. Right. And therefore, I think from the FSB's point of view, it wouldn't want to spend political capital taking over or trying to take over a fairly moribund external intelligence service when it needs its political capital for internal fights.
So you basically see the status quo staying with the three main intelligence services at this point.
This time, I think this is not the time for a massive reorganization. This is not the time to try and expand the powers of the FSB. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think this is a big enough case.
Mm. Now, the FSB has been very, very quiet since Putin's return to the Kremlin. As you've pointed out on numerous occasions, it has been the investigative committee that has taken the lead internally in Russia. But the FSB is never not doing anything. So you have to wonder what they're up to right now. And as you said, is it that all of their efforts are centered on keeping an eye on the investigative committee and making sure it doesn't lose any turf there?
Well, I don't know about all the secrets situation, including FSB and all other secret agencies and so on. But I think that this investigative committee now is trying to play a role of some sort of FBI in Russia. I think so.
I'm calling them the politics police. This is the new name I've thought of for the investigation.
In Russian historical terms, it's a so-called third department.
Yes.
Третье отделение. But I'd like to draw your attention to another political dimension of the problem. This is, let's introduce a new kind of political definition of modern Russia. A main political problem, in my opinion, of modern Russia is the problem of the failed spies. This is a country, this is a government, this is a state of failed spies, from Putin to Anna Chapman, Lugovoy. Don't forget, right. He's MP in the State Duma, and a lot of people. So don't forget about all former KGB agents in business, right, and so on. And by the way, they are all failed because Soviet Union collapsed. They failed, yeah? They lose this battle, and now they try not to regain, but to survive. And all this problem that we are discussing now, it's a problem of, surviving of some structures of secret police and secret services. It's a kind of paranoid bureaucratic game. And that is not a real, state politics or state, trend, increasing espionage because we want to modernize economy and so on. And I just can agree with Mark in this sense because, yes, sure, that is all about bureaucracy. That is all about the game of several secret agencies and trying to explain all this budget money they spend on, these things.
Well, that actually is a pretty good segue, because I'd like to talk. We've been talking about these failed spies.
Celebrating today.
We're not going to go to Putin yet.
Sorry, not quite yet.
Before we do go to Putin, I wanted to talk about something Mark raised here, is this struggle between the FSB and the investigative committee in the domestic arena. Now, there have been reports throughout the week that the investigative committee is that Alexander Bastrykin is going to get his long-standing wish to unite the investigative arms of the Interior Ministry, the MVD, and the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service into one super agency. It looks like Bastrykin has won that battle, if you can believe. Well, the Kremlin's actually, according to Nezavisimaya Gazeta, drafted a law that's on its way to the Duma that would enshrine that. There's also reports, however, that the investigative committee is going to be put back under the control of the prosecutor general's office, where Bastykin fought a tough bureaucratic battle to get it out from under that control so he could report directly to the president. Mark, can you comment on this? What do you see going on here? And what's the FSB doing in all of this, in this battle among the, as Kirill called them, the failed spies?
Yes, I must admit, Country of Failed Spies, I love that. If nothing else, it's a great book title there. first of all, in terms of the investigative committee taking over the investigations elements of the other agencies, I mean, that's already taking place. They're already sort of accumulating investigators from the MVD, from the Anti-Narcotics Service, and so forth. So really, we're just talking about the formalization of a process that is taking place. Very much over the protests of the Interior Ministry and the other agencies. But exactly, when the Kremlin gives with one hand and takes away with the other, I think because there is this very clear awareness, and it's the sort of thing which tripped up the FSB in the past. I mean, their desire to create a sort of KGB Mark II was something that, I suppose, you know, Putin fully understood. But he never let them have it, in part because I think he's wily enough to realize that at that point you create a super agency which becomes very, very powerful. And although in the past it's been his great support, kingmakers can very easily become kingbreakers. Mm-hmm. And therefore he wanted to keep the FSB hungry and with a reason to have to look up to the great decider with hope. Likewise, I think giving the investigative committee all these extra resources would have meant vastly empowering Bastrykin. So I think there is a sense of, well, how can we counterweight it? And also the fact that, you know, Bastrykin has been very much leading the charge against the opposition. Mm-hmm. He's been the one that's been so keen on essentially pushing really quite a hard line. And although it hasn't gone disastrously badly, nor has it succeeded. And therefore, I think there is that sense that he is slightly on probation at the moment. And therefore, I think placing him under the prosecutor's office is a way of emphasizing that, well, you know, yes, you've been our favorite, but that doesn't have to last forever, and you still have to produce results.
And he's been embarrassing the Kremlin fairly consistently over the past several months with his properties in the Czech Republic, his properties in Italy,
Spain,
threatening journalists out in the forest, and so on and so forth.
He has had a phenomenal capacity for, you know, embarrassing gaffes. And okay, in part it's because he's got lots of enemies that are eager to highlight them, but it is also that it's entirely his own fault.
Right. Now, it looks like if he is, and this is all, again, this is all media speculation, but it all fits. And if the investigative committee is placed under the prosecutor's office, it probably will not be under Prosecutor General Yuri Chaika, who was closer to the Medvedev than Putin, and who is not really one of the boys in terms of Putin's inner circle. It looks like, again, if you can believe the media speculation, that Dmitry Kozak may be appointed prosecutor general, which is something that Mr. Kozak has long wanted. And let's face it, he's been Russia's Mr. Fix-It. I mean, when Putin has an intractable problem he needs fixed, he tends to give it to Kozak. And this would solve a series of problems. Bastrykin gets his expanded investigative committee, but it's under Kozak's watchful eye. Putin, according to my information, considers Kozak very reliable and very loyal. Does this look like a realistic scenario to you?
I think it does. Again, as you say, it provides, you know, everyone seems to get enough of what they want. Bastrykin gets his empowered committee, but in order to make sure that he's still a tame attack dog, you have Kozak, who is not only loyal, but he's also tough. I mean, this was the issue with Chaika. He really wasn't a bare knuckles political fighter, and therefore Bastrykin was able to humiliate him.
No, I watched Kozak in action.
It's interesting because Bastrykin wants to get rid of him.
Yeah, you're right. Bastrykin wants to get rid of Chaika. That's another thing. But as they say, be careful what you wish for. You may get it, because I've watched Kozak in action when he was a vice governor in St. Petersburg in the 90s. He is one skilled bureaucrat, and he is one tough customer, and he's extremely competent. And unlike many in Russian officialdom, he's a workaholic. You know, he gets up before noon, you know. So, Kirill, is there anything you want to add before we move on?
I think historically this idea of super agency is very dangerous, and Putin has to understand this, or, you know, some of his aides who really know Russian history. In Russian history, in Soviet history, there was just a brief period when Soviet Union had its super secret agency. It was NKVD in the 20s and in 1930s. Even Stalin divided this agency into NKVD and GPU, just normal police and, kind of KGB, future KGB, right, and so on. So it's better. If you know history, so just remember Napoleon Bonaparte, who divided all secret services and all these police departments into five or six various departments or agencies, and they spied on each other. And that was a game in which Napoleon, in his domestic policy, was just unbeatable. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, Stalin did these things in 1940s and the beginning of 1950s. And after that, during Khrushchev and especially Brezhnev rule, that was a very harsh competition between, for instance, militia and KGB, and even an open conflict between them in the beginning of 1980s, and the same the famous case of General Orlov and so on. So I think that Putin will never go to such decision to organize such
to allow the FSB to swallow the SVR,
or to allow investigative committee to swallow someone. So I think it's better for him. It's not an advice.
Right.
So I'm speaking for those who are listening.
That fancy software is probably listening to you, Kirill.
Yes.
It's all going in our files.
This is not an advice, a direct advice, but I try to hint.
All right. Well, in a few moments, we'll take a look at one former spy who will be celebrating a very special day this weekend. Can you guess who that is? I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. And on the line from New York City is Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU and an expert on Russia's security services. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Президент Путин отметит юбилей без пышных торжеств. Он отпразднует
7 октября будет отмечать юбилей президента.
И в этот прекрасный солнечный день, октябрьский,
мы хотим пожелать вам творческих успехов
и внуков.
Владимир Владимирович, у вас сегодня день рождения.
07-10-52 года, Vladimir Putin celebrates his 60th birthday on Sunday, and we can expect the usual accolades from Russia's ruling elite. The youth wing of the ruling United Russia Party will hold events across the country, including hanging a massive sign on a bridge in Rostov-na-Don and inviting passersby in Chelyabinsk to sign a giant postcard. There's also a gala concert planned for VIPs only in Putin's native St. Petersburg. Putin's birthday will also be marked by the opposition, however. A Facebook page called Let's Help an Old Man Retire is taking suggestions for gifts for the president, which will be presented on Sunday. Kirill, let's start with you, since you've seen many Kremlin leaders celebrate their birthdays over the years. Starting, I believe, with was it Khrushchev or
no,
Brezhnev?
No, I know.
I think
3 months old when this plot against Khrushchev happened in 1964. I was 2 years old when Brezhnev celebrated his 60th anniversary, but I was 12 years old when Brezhnev celebrated his most famous anniversary.
So how do the Putin birthday celebrations compare to the Brezhnev? I mean, how is this marked?
First of all, Putin, unlike Brezhnev, didn't write his book. Because do you remember that Brezhnev, he didn't write this first and second and third book, Malaya Zemlya, The Small Land, but had been signed, like, you know, he wrote it about the war and his heroic behavior during the war and so on. So this anniversary in 1976 was a starting point of all this idiotic cult of Brezhnev in his late, late 5 or 6 years of his rule. So that was the beginning of this story of Brezhnev, like as a field marshal, Brezhnev like as a war hero, Brezhnev as a main figure in modernization of Soviet economy after the Second World War, and so on and so on and so on. So it was very ridiculous. It was, I remember, I was 12 years old and then, 13 and so on, but it was, everyone understood that this is very ridiculous, this is very shameful, and all of them, including me, all of us, including me, of course, we just had fun. Mm-hmm. Because there were a lot of jokes, a lot of anecdotes about Brezhnev, about his books, about his, part in the Great Patriotic War, and so on. Putin is absolutely different in this sense. But it's very interesting that the attitude of the society is not the same, but it's similar, that I remember was in 1976. That is the question. It's not the question of the leader. Of course, Putin is not a Soviet or communist leader. Of course, Putin is, I'd like to compare him to, some Latin American dictators, mm-hmm. but not to Brezhnev, Khrushchev, or even Andropov, and so on. But all this Soviet style, or maybe old Russian style of celebrating, of all this, VIP concerts for some people, but not for Putin. He's in Tajikistan.
Well, no, Putin is going to be absent from the public on that day.
Yes, he's absolutely absent.
Was it that way in the Soviet time? Was Brezhnev visible in the public on his birthday?
Absolutely. He was visible. He was on TV screen. He was receiving all these, orders and so mm-hmm. on. And he was absolutely happy with all this celebration, mm-hmm. All these celebrations like a child, mm-hmm. like a child. That was, I have, some warm memories about this.
We were talking off mic about some of your warm memories when you were studying English school.
When I started English in school, the first text that we had to know by heart began with the sentence. General Secretary of CPSU Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev was born in December 19 of 1906 in Dneprodzerzhinsk or something like this. So I still remember this. So that was, speaking seriously, of course, that was the, last 15 years of Soviet Union. That was the period of, so-called late socialism. That was the period when the system and the ideology rot. Mm-hmm. Just wrote, and these rusty words, these rusty ideas, this sophisticated rubbish of all this CPSU Congress resolutions and so on, that was a very interesting for historians. Now, that is the very interesting, source for analyzing, about the late or last days, last years of a great, it's a great ideological trend. Communism was and still is a great ideological trend. So we can see on several thousand examples how it, this happens. How this happens. How this ideology wrote how this ideology failed and the very mechanism of the change of the, you know, inside the consciousness and public mind and so on. What do we see now? We don't have any ideology.
Right. Yes. That was the first. I was going to note that, but yeah.
Secondly, even Orthodox Church, who is now in full swing, even Orthodox Church cannot say something about Putin's anniversary. It's very interesting. So when it was, in Soviet times, chiefs of Soviet ideology, they spoke a lot about, role of Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev in this historical role. Who can speak about the historical role of Vladimir Putin in this? Who? Priest, politician, journalist, writer, or pop singer?
Right.
I think pop singer.
You think we'll be hearing most from pop singers? Yeah. Mark, do you want to jump in here with any observations?
Yeah, I mean, it is a lovely sort of recreation of the sort of the Soviet era. Often it was a cult of personality as a surrogate for having a personality. But I think I'd really want to agree and pick up with the sort of point that Kirill made. It was about, who is it for? And again, I can't help but feel that, given that sort of Putin's not going to be there, but clearly he must have allowed this to happen. But I can't help but feel that it's really, again, almost driven by metrics. It's driven by local officials, it's driven by the youth movement and so forth, wanting to demonstrate their loyalty to Putin and to the movement, and creating activity that isn't going to convince anyone. It's not as if people are going to sort of say, I was ambivalent about that Putin guy, but look at this great big birthday card. He clearly must be a fine chap. But on the other hand, and you've mentioned in the past the extent to which the opposition almost used the asymmetric warfare of humor against the power of the Kremlin. I mean, if anyone's getting a birthday gift, it's precisely the opposition in terms of all these over-the-top and schmaltzy sort of demonstrations of respect for Putin. Again, just simply Putin as an epic figure of our time, which is going to allow them to, again, sort of, as you said, with this sort of, let's let an old man retire. If we're talking about modern Russia as basically being the failed spy's retirement plan, It definitely sort of plays to that role of Putin.
Yeah, and I'm actually very curious about what kind of gift, because they're having a contest on Facebook on this page, Let's Let an Old Man Retire, Let's Help an Old Man Retire. They're having a contest to create who can come up with the best gift for Putin. And my understanding is that they were supposed to be gathering in Moscow on Sunday at 4 p.m., local time to make some kind of presentation of this gift. Yeah. Now, I don't know if they got permission for that demonstration or not. Gathering.
We'll see if the authorities, try to arrest them or do something like this in the very day or before Putin's birthday.
Right.
Not tomorrow, this great festivity and so on. But I'd like to draw your attention to another one important thing. As we told, Putin distanced himself from all these celebrations.
Yes.
So in some sense, he is telling, let them, my people, celebrate my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. It's like, it's not like kind of behavior of Soviet leader. It's a sort of behavior of Russian Tsar.
Mm-hmm.
Not like Nicholas II, but like Ivan the Terrible. Because Ivan the Terrible, that was the ruler who tried to distance himself from all these things which were happening in Moscow. Just remember this Oprichnin in the case and so on, when he fled to Alexandrovsk and established a new court and a new state just outside Moscow. In some sense, Putin, I think he's unaware about this, but he's just repeating mildly repeating this attitude. It's not just policy, it's attitude to their own people, their nation. They don't trust them. They don't trust them. Let them celebrate. Let them sing and, you know, dance and whatever. I'll be in Tajikistan.
Receiving a rifle as a gift. Giving a rifle as a gift. Yeah. Any final thoughts, Mark, before we wrap this up? I'm watching the clock, and I know you have an appointment.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned this. Exactly. He gave Tajik President Rahmon a sniper rifle, which, again, sort of says something about his notion of what makes for a fun birthday celebration. I mean, the point I make is, obviously, sort of, you know, it's fun for the opposition to say, you know, let's let a grandfather retire. But, I mean, it's worth mentioning, I mean, he's 60. Brezhnev was 58. When he became boss, Gorbachev was a stripling at 54. Mm-hmm. Stalin, although, I mean, he became general secretary relatively young, but that was in the days when general secretary wasn't a big job. If you think of his really sort of coming to power with the Kirov murder, I mean, he was 56. Mm-hmm. So again, I think in this level, although it would be nice to think of Putin sort of naturally reaching the end of his political life and it's time for him to get some slippers and go off to write or commission his memoirs. In Russian terms, he is, alas, still a stripling. It's going to be politics rather than age that eventually gets rid of him, quite frankly.
Yeah, he'll be in his, or if he serves through the constitutional limit of assuming he wins a second 6-year term, he'll be, what, 72?
70-something.
72, I believe, when it's all over. So Putin is still a very young man, at least by the standards of Soviet leaders, or even by the standard of the first post-Soviet Russian leader, because Yeltsin was no youngster when he wrapped up. All right, well, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me here in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service, and on the line from New York City has been Mark Galliotti, professor at NYU and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Always glad to add to my dossier in Moscow.
Always glad to have you adding to your dossier in Moscow. I would also like to thank our outstanding producer, Tanya Konchova. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can also read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.